Okay, let's unpack this. We've been provided with a serious stack of sources that really tackle one of the most complex and I think dangerously misframed issues right now:
For sure.
federal immigration enforcement. And we are not talking about, border processing or walls.
None at all.
We're talking about something much deeper: a fundamental constitutional crisis over the use of federal police power deep inside the interior of the United States.
That's absolutely right. And the narrative you often hear pits executive action against state resistance.
Right, like it's a political battle.
But our sources, they pull back the curtain on the actual legal argument. So our mission for you, the listener, is to really analyze this material. It's about recent fatal encounters involving ICE agents, but happening far from the border.
In cities, residential neighborhoods.
Exactly. And to understand the central constitutional question they raise.
These encounters are really the flashpoint, aren't they? It's where legal theory turns into, well, lethal force. The sources suggest the core issue isn't even immigration policy itself.
No, it's a challenge to the constitutional structure that is supposed to govern all domestic policing.
So what's the question we're asking then?
We're asking a very hard question. Can executive agencies exercise domestic police power? I mean, on your street, in your city, without the oversight of neutral judges?
And without transparent identification.
And crucially, without accountability to state criminal law, even when lethal force is used.
Wow. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of all that, the judiciary has already started to weigh in, sort of draw a line in the sand. We have the United States v. State of New York decision upholding the Protect Our Courts Act, or POCA.
POCA is critical here. It's a major judicial response to what it saw as executive overreach. What the act did and what the court upheld was the state's right to limit federal immigration enforcement inside and around its own courthouses.
Okay, so that's a huge deal.
It is, because the decision reinforces that federal enforcement authority has to flow from Congress, clearly and lawfully, not just from an agency's, desire for operational efficiency.
So if the executive branch can't just assert power inside a state courthouse, that really sets the stage for defining where they can assert power. Let's establish that legal geography.
Exactly. We have to start with the foundational principle, the distinction between border power and interior power. Federal immigration authority is, well, it's highly specific.
What do you mean by specific?
Historically, courts have tolerated very narrow exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, things like suspicionless stops or searches.
But only near the border, right?
Right. At ports of entry, for example, based on the unique necessities of, defending the nation's periphery.
Okay, and here's where it gets really interesting, and frankly, pretty dangerous. Those exceptions, that specialized border logic, they do not constitutionally travel inland.
They absolutely do not.
The moment federal enforcement moves into the interior city streets, parking lots, workplaces, those agents are supposed to be subject to the exact same constitutional policing rules as every other cop.
That's the key. Rules like warrant requirements, individualized suspicion, and the objective standard for use of force.
And the source material is clear that the danger is when agencies just collapse this distinction. They start invoking border logic to justify what becomes a kind of roving domestic police authority.
Hundreds or even thousands of miles from any international boundary, and this collapse is clearest when you look at the
You
paperwork.
mean the warrants?
Specifically, the difference between an administrative warrant and a judicial warrant. This is the constitutional defect right at the center of all this.
Okay, let's spell that out because it's a crucial difference. An administrative warrant. What is it?
It's purely an executive document. It's issued under civil authority, signed by an agency official, a supervisor, maybe. It reflects no judicial determination of probable cause.
So it's just internal agency paperwork.
Essentially, yes, but a judicial warrant.
That's completely different.
entirely different. That's a command of law backed by Article 3 judicial power. It's issued by a neutral, detached magistrate, and it's grounded squarely in the Fourth Amendment.
Meaning there's independent proof that a crime was committed.
Exactly. Probable cause. So when you treat the administrative one like the judicial one, you're essentially replacing the Bill of Rights with an agency memo.
But doesn't the agency argue that administrative warrants are just, necessary for efficiency? Given the sheer volume of cases, is this just about speed versus process?
It is, but the Constitution prioritizes process over convenience. The sources argue that operational convenience can't be allowed to erode fundamental rights. And look at the practical consequences for, say, local law enforcement.
If they're asked to assist.
Right. If a local police department helps with a civil arrest based only on that administrative warrant, they are exposing themselves to immense constitutional liability.
What kind of liability are we talking about here?
We're talking unlawful seizure, false arrest claims, massive federal lawsuits against the individual officers in their town or city.
So it's a huge risk for them.
A huge risk, because that administrative warrant offers zero constitutional protection for detaining someone. It's a civil request, not a judicial command. So when a local department refuses to honor those warrants, it's not obstruction.
It's constitutional compliance. They're protecting their community from false arrest claims.
That's it. They're protecting their own officers and their taxpayers.
That makes perfect sense.
Oh.
Okay, so let's shift to the federal officers themselves. This brings us to the second major line the courts have to draw, the conditional nature of federal immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Federal agents often claim supremacy clause immunity, which sounds like they're just beyond the reach of state law. But how strong is that shield, really?
It's far from absolute. Immunity is conditional. It is not a blanket exemption. A federal officer is immune from state prosecution only when they are acting strictly within the scope of lawful federal authority and doing no more than what is necessary and proper to carry out that authority.
So the implication is, if the enforcement action wasn't properly authorized to begin with, like trying civil arrest without a judicial warrant, the immunity claim is already shaky.
It's already on thin ice, exactly. But let's connect this doctrine to lethal force. Interior shootings test this necessity doctrine severely. Any claim that the use of force was necessary is often weakened by the agency's own operational record.
I remember you mentioned a federal report about this.
Yes, the source material has this powerful reference to a 2013 review. It was done by the Police Executive Research Forum, or PEERF.
And this wasn't some outside group, right?
Not at all. This was a study commissioned by the agency's own oversight body, and it documented systemic misuse of deadly force in immigration enforcement.
What exactly did it find that makes the necessity defense so fragile?
It found patterns of avoidable escalation, especially during vehicle encounters where agents would place themselves in the path of a moving car.
A tactic most police departments banned years ago.
It also found agents throwing objects, creating confrontations. The review concluded that agents repeatedly put themselves in avoidable, self-created danger, and then used that danger to justify lethal force.
And the recommendation was what?
Unambiguous. Agents should have disengaged or used less lethal alternatives in many of these cases.
That's a devastating detail. Mm. If the agency was officially warned back in 2013 that its own tactics lead to foreseeable, avoidable violence, and those tactics persist,
then the claim that the resulting force was necessary and proper becomes extremely difficult to sustain under the immunity test. The force wasn't necessary. The escalation was foreseeable.
That is the core legal insight. So immunity collapses when federal agents violate neutral state safety laws like reckless driving or use force that isn't proportionate.
Exactly. And relying on those civil administrative warrants just makes it even weaker because you're using a civil tool in a situation that escalates to criminal levels of violence.
Okay, let's shift the framing again. Away from individual liability to the state-level resistance we see in the news, what the media often calls sanctuary.
It's not really that. It's structural. Constitutional.
You're calling it anti-commandeering.
The source material is adamant that this resistance is rooted in the 10th Amendment. It's not just a policy preference, it's a legal mandate. The federal government cannot compel states or their officers to administer or enforce federal programs.
So states are constitutionally entitled to just say no. They can decline to participate in civil immigration enforcement, refuse to honor detainers.
Absolutely. The state officer works for the state, not the federal government. They can't be conscripted to enforce federal law. So when states refuse, it's actually constitutional compliance.
It's about constitutional structure versus an executive mandate. Okay, but let's look at how this authority still drifts into general policing, even when a state isn't helping. We've established border power doesn't travel. But how do they get around the Fourth Amendment deep inside the country?
This is where we have to tackle what the sources call the beyond the border myth. The Supreme Court has repeatedly rejected extending that border authority inland.
In what cases?
Cases like Almeida Sanchez and Brignone Ponce. The court was clear. Interior stops, whether it's a car or a person on the street, require reasonable, individualized suspicion. You can't just stop people based on generalized assumptions.
You can't just escape the rule against suspicionless stops by calling them administrative or civil immigration checks.
Precisely. The Fourth Amendment doesn't just disappear. When federal agents stop someone in a city, they are engaging in domestic law enforcement. That requires a lawful reason to believe that specific person has violated the law.
And stops without that clear reason are inherently coercive.
And carry a huge foreseeable risk of escalation because the stop itself is unlawful from the start.
Which leads us directly to maybe the most visible tactical issue we see, the normalization of masked, non-identifiable agents operating in the interior.
Yes.
I mean, American policing relies on the idea that lawful authority has to be identifiable. Uniforms, badges, clear communication.
Mask enforcement completely undermines the legitimacy of the force being used. The sources are clear on this. Anonymity increases the risk of misidentification, panic, and defensive resistance.
Of course. If you're stopped by an unidentified person in tactical gear, your natural response is going to be defensive. It's much different from being stopped by a uniformed officer.
And if that tactic itself, the anonymity, creates conditions that make a violent reaction more likely, well, that completely undermines the use of force standards.
So how does that work legally?
Well, the use of force has to be judged by the standard of objective reasonableness. If the agent's own tactical choice, like going in masked or stepping in front of a car, is what created the necessity for lethal force,
then the force itself isn't objectively reasonable.
It can't be. The foreseeable escalation basically cancels out the later claim that the force was necessary.
So this isn't just about a single bad judgment call. It's about a structural, tactical choice that is just incompatible with constitutional policing.
That's it, exactly. Masked enforcement is a choice. And when that choice foreseeably leads to violence in the interior, it can't be shielded by claims of federal supremacy.
So let's bring these four pressure points together. We have administrative warrants instead of judges. We have conditional immunity that depends on necessity. We have state refusal rooted in anti-commandeering. And we have tactics like mask enforcement that foreseeably escalate violence. What does this all mean for you, the listener?
It means that these converging issues are they're structural deviations from constitutional governance. These aren't just minor policy disagreements. They're attempts to displace judicial oversight and local accountability with pure executive power.
And the POCA decision you mentioned at the start.
That acts as a clear signal that courts are willing to draw the line. Efficiency cannot replace legality, and an agency can't just invent authority where Congress has been silent.
So the conflict, according to our sources, is not an argument against immigration enforcement itself.
No, not at all. It's an argument for constitutional policing.
For applying the same rules to everyone.
Yes. When lethal force is used in the interior under administrative authority alone, the rule of law is being displaced. These agents are operating in complex, diverse communities, not isolated border zones. The rules of the interior have to apply.
And there's a real institutional danger here, too. Right. The sources point out the risk of officials suggesting their agents operate beyond the reach of state law.
That rhetoric encourages boundary pushing. And paradoxically, it exposes those same agents to far greater liability when the courts inevitably reject the claim of absolute immunity.
Especially in fatal encounter cases.
The Supreme Court has been clear. Immunity only attaches to lawful and necessary conduct. When agencies substitute their own policy preference for clear law from Congress, they're putting their own people at risk. They are inviting legal and institutional collapse.
We've covered a lot of complex ground here, defining boundaries between federal and state power, judicial and executive authority, and border versus interior enforcement. It's a powerful deep dive into the legal architecture behind the headlines.
It is. And while federal authority is supreme where Congress has spoken and enforcement is lawful, the question raised by the sources is whether these executive agencies will respect the constitutional lines that have already been drawn by the courts.
Lines reinforced by POCA and decades of jurisprudence.
Exactly. Or will they continue to push those boundaries until they force the judiciary to draw them again? Perhaps under circumstances far graver than a civil courthouse dispute. Maybe in the context of a criminal prosecution of a federal agent.
That's a sobering thought.
And that distinction between the lawful execution of duties and unauthorized reckless conduct that's just cloaked in federal rhetoric, that is something critical for you to mull over as you see these concepts of warrants, immunity, and accountability play out in the news.